Okay, yeah, there's Wi-Fi. We're going to get started, folks. Thank you all for coming. I'm Wes Sullins. Mary's going to kick us off. Mary Saul, who also works at Stop Waste here.
Can you hear me? Do we need to speak the microphone?
We need it for the recorder.
We need the microphone, please.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. Bad combination. Thank you, everyone, for coming. My name is Mary Saul. I'm staff here at Stop Waste. I manage our C&D recycling program. I see some familiar faces and some new faces, so thank you. The goal of today's meeting is to really do some education regarding C&D recycling, regulations that are new as well as some in place, to give you an overview. Also to learn about what happens to that C&D material when it leaves a job site and goes to a facility. We all know it just doesn't go away, but how is it handled? Just to learn a little bit more about the C&D recycling process. These are really very short snapshots of larger topics, but we just wanted to give an overview of what's happening currently in the C&D recycling world. Just a couple of housekeeping items. For those of you who haven't been to our building before, the two bathrooms are right outside to the left of the double doors. If you need to take a phone call, if you can take it outside. If you have parked in the street, City of Oakland can be very vicious about parking tickets, so please put your timer on. If you need to hop out to feed the meter, we understand, but I don't want you to get a ticket coming to the meeting. So before we get started, I thought it would be helpful, since there's some new faces in the room, to get a feel for who's here, where you work, and how your work intersects with the C&D recycling program. So as I mentioned, I'm a senior program manager here, and I manage the C&D recycling program. And maybe we could just go around the room. I don't know. Do we need the microphone for this? That's okay. I think it's kind of awkward. Yeah. So if you could just start over here. Just stand up, share your name, where you work, and how C&D recycling relates with your duties.
Program in our division.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for coming and giving that brief introduction. So we have two new people who just asked. Sorry to put you on the spot. Just share with us your name, where you work, and your role with C&D Recycling. Welcome. Good, glad to hear it. And we have one more straggler. I hate to put you on the spot, but we're going to get started. If you could just introduce yourself and where you work.
Chris Becker, I run the education program for Building Green.
Great, welcome, Chris. Okay, thank you. Woo. So we're going to get started. I'm going to turn this over to my colleague, Wes Sullins, who's going to give an overview on the regulatory and some green building rating programs regarding C&D recycling requirements. We will have a little time for Q&A after each of the panelists present, but there'll be a lot of time after. We're serving lunch at noon from Liba Falafel. We have enough for everybody, and it's a great opportunity to network with folks that you saw stand up and introduce themselves and maybe bounce some ideas or get some more information. So please join us for that. And with that, I'll turn it over to Wes.
Thank you, Mary. A little bit of housekeeping I need to read, sorry. Cell phone conversations, if you have those, please take them outside, not in the hallway. Don't congregate in the reception area, and then don't enter areas of the building that are employee only. Sorry to have to say those things, but cover our bases here. And then if you want Wi-Fi access, there's a sign in the back that has the password and the network. Those are important things. Okay, so today we have a... Yes? The restrooms, yes, are...
Out the doors to your left.
Okay, great.
Yes, thank you. So today we've got a really interesting lineup, I think, of three panels. The first one is kind of... I'm going to give an overview of the regulations and some of the movements in the industry that are affecting C&D recycling. And then we'll go into panel first. We've got our speakers up here, including Michael, who's coming, to talk about haulers and facility operators. And each presenter will have 10 minutes to do a brief presentation, and then we'll have 5 minutes for Q&A afterward. But I think this is a pretty small crowd. We seem to be pretty talkative, so let's keep it as a dialogue if we want. Then we'll have a second panel of contractors. Both Michael and Emily will talk about best practices from the construction site. And we'll wrap it up with the city representatives of Dennis and Carrie over in this corner talking about implementing C&D in their city. And then we'll have lunch and, as Mary said, networking over lunch. So I'm just going to try to set the stage a bit, and then we'll turn it over to our first panel. Any questions before I get started? No? Okay. Try not to get blinded here. So there's a number of things affecting construction waste and recycling in California and locally. The most dominant one, I think, that's changed since 2011 is our Green Building Code, which now requires construction recycling on essentially every permitted project that comes through building departments. But there's other things happening nationally. This is a map of the International Construction Code and the Green Code, for that matter. And you see that there's adoptions happening across the country, whether they're cities or states, it depends on the jurisdiction. And then, of course, in California, we have our own green code. But all of these areas that have highlighted colors on the map have at least a 50% recycling requirement for pretty much every project. Sort of in the middle spectrum, or the more market leadership spectrum, is the LEED rating system. Has everyone heard of LEED? Okay, Leadership in Energy Environmental Design. It's put out by an international nonprofit that basically rates buildings based on their sustainability, and one of those metrics is construction waste recycling. So this has kind of been a drive for, I think, almost half of all construction in the commercial sector now is green in some way by dollar value, and that's mostly LEED, that's codes, and that's other things too. More at the top end of the spectrum is something called the Living Building Challenge, which we'll talk a little bit more in some of the presentations following. But it's really on the innovative or cutting edge. And so I like to show this slide, which has kind of the timeline on the bottom, relative sort of sustainability or green indicator on the left with this idea of some place being zero impact. And then you've got the building codes and green codes coming on, taking along some of these basic kind of common green building strategies. And the rating systems have to then iterate on top of that in order to have this kind of stratification and pull from the industry. And what we're seeing in California is definitely the green building codes are increasing in stringency, and the rating systems are kind of advancing on top of those. So it's an interesting dynamic that sort of I think of as having a level of minimum requirements. And again, in C and D, we've got this definitely happening. Then you've got some market leaders, some best practices, and then you've got innovation stuff, really things that are on the cutting edge and getting towards this zero impact. So what does that mean? Well, for the regulatory side, the requirements side, here's a quick slide on green building, the CalGreen code. And so since 2011, 50% recycling has been required on all projects. It started out as new construction, and then it's phased in over time to cover smaller renovations, additions, alterations, multifamily. And there's also this voluntary portion of the code, which some jurisdictions have adopted as requirements, that have these additional tiers, 65% recycling, and even 75 or 80% as a requirement for C&D. But this is changing a bit. The building code just got updated. It's actually now in kind of final public comment version. And there's a provision in there to be, where's my red, 65% is going to be the new requirement statewide for construction, demolition, recycling. And that will apply to all types of construction, again, that's covered by this code. Interestingly, they're also proposing, the building code folks are, that the tiers don't bump up to another level of recycling above that, but they add a third-party facility diversion rate as a requirement for the voluntary measures. And Tier 2 is that plus 75. The idea being what's important beyond the 65% mark is getting a better reporting of the diversion, because there's a lot of, probably as we've all seen, there's many ways you can document diversion on construction waste on a project, and the thing that's lacking in a lot of ways is consistency and accuracy. And we at Stop Waste have been working on doing some facility kind of second-party audits to look at diversion rates, and it's interesting to see that it's all kind of all over the place. So we've also been do I get here? Not yet. We've also been promoting or trying to work for a third-party certification system for these facilities to try to get some consistency in reporting. So that's kind of the regulatory level. That's the floor of the industry. As of 2017, most likely we'll see 65% statewide as a requirement. Now, what does that mean on projects? This is a slide I took from looking at LEED buildings, and there were, what's the sample size? And these are the sample sizes for the relatives bars. This is several hundred projects statewide. Oh, there it is. So 547 of LEED version 2 and 148 of LEED version 3. So quite a few projects statewide looking at the major statistical areas of the state and how many of the projects that got LEED certified achieved a 75% diversion rate. So the LEED has a point you can get, 2 points actually, for 75% diversion. And what we see is statewide, nearly every project gets both those points. And that's consistent with one of the reasons the state can up its recycling rate, as we're seeing a lot of this happening. So to address that, LEED just went through an update, LEED version 4, and there's some nuances that are different. They're looking at leadership and C&D in a different way. Things like reuse and deconstruction and salvage are now more influenced or more important in LEED than they were in previous versions. Take-back programs are recognized now. So if you've got pallets of ceiling tiles or carpet or something, that can consider as diversion more than before. Things like source separation on site of construction materials. And then when you do send things to a facility, do it to a really good one that's high performing. This is to indicate tracking, so some kind of good reporting consistency. And especially in Europe, they do a lot of incineration of waste, and there's some clean burning standards that have put into LEED to address the best in class of those types of facilities. So LEED has kind of taken a step up, and I'll show a little bit more on the requirements right here for the version of LEED version 4. Which is, we still have these points of 50% diversion, but ADC is no longer considered recycling, and you must divert at least 3 streams of material. So this is essentially requiring source separation to get that first point in LEED. and 2 points if you do a 75% diversion overall with 4 material streams. So again, source separation or salvage or take back, all considered a stream and lead. And then there's this extra kind of bonus point if the facility you send to, your mixed facility, has a third-party verified recycling rate. So this provides a new framework for looking at the way you do diversion. It's no longer just a percentage that has to be recycled. We're getting more nuanced, right? This is more technical, which we thought would be a great reason to have a workshop like this today to try to unpack this. And here's a screenshot of, I think that's your facility, isn't it, Michael?
No.
of Recycling Certification Institute, which is the third-party verified recycling certification scheme that's recognized by LEED for the pilot credit. And the thing that's neat about this is when you dig into the details on a certified facility, this is all public, you get a recycling rate with and without ADC. Those are not necessarily your numbers. You'll show yours later. But the point is, this is trying to get a more transparent disclosure of what's actually happening to your waste. It's great to put everything in a bin and send it to a facility that claims a high diversion rate, but what really happens to those materials? Those are some of the questions that are being asked. Now, on the innovation side, I'll go back to the Living Building Challenge, which was a rating system that was incubated up in Seattle and Portland area and has made its way into the Bay Area. It's actually got the most projects registered in California now because some big players like Google and some of the big tech industry have adopted this as their rating system of choice. And here's an example of a building. The things that make Living Building Challenge different is it's really just 5 principles. No water. You can't use any more water than falls on site. You can't meet any more energy than what falls on your site. You can't hook up to the sewer. You have to do composting toilets or something like that. They basically have a zero waste policy, which translates to somewhere around less than 3 or 5%. And they get into things like red list chemicals, not having toxic materials in your products that are brought into the building. And what's notable here is this building itself, to get permitted because of these requirements, took 12 changes to the way they do business in the city. And this was actually a partnership between the city and the private industry, the Bullet Foundation. But I want to dig a little bit into the materials pedal because that's the part that I think has the most relevant for us. There's a lot on the screen here, but the highlights, let me see if they work. Yeah. So they require you have to have salvage materials on your project to get certified. 1 salvage material per 500 square meters of the building. So that's an interesting, they're calling this net positive waste. The idea being you're contributing to not just reducing waste, but actually making use of waste products as a net positive. And then when you get into the individual materials, they have specifics on diversion numbers, no ADC, no incineration for all of these. So these are very aspirational goals, and I'm not sure if projects can meet all of these, certainly not in all areas, and there's got to be some pretty different strategies used on site to meet these goals, and in different markets too. But there's lots of, you see this little footnote there, there are some little caveats that can play into if conditions don't permit for some of these things. So as a summary, here's a quick snapshot, well it's not quick, we've got the codes on the side. I didn't cover in any detail, but I did mention the International Green Code and ASHRAE, which is another version of that. And here's the requirements for diversion amount, what's required or gives points, whether source separation is something that's listed as a requirement, if waste to energy or incineration is considered recycling. And as you can see, the deeper you go down, the more the stringency increases. Whether or not alternative daily cover is considered recycling. At the end there, the bottom there, you see a lot of no's. There's this option of waste generation minimization that showed up in a number of places, so just something to be aware of, that if you generate on-site less than these thresholds, there's a way to get either credit or meet the requirements. And then whether or not third-party facility verification gets you credit or any recognition. So what we kind of see is as you go from, again, the kind of regulatory floor, the market-leading things, and then the innovation, it gets increasingly stringent. And so it provides a pretty interesting snapshot of the way the industry is at least moving today. And I should say we're going to put all of these presentations on our website with downloads, so you can download these afterward. So that's my wrap-up for kind of the state of affairs. Any questions or comments before we move on? There's a lot of information. Yeah, Marcy.
I was just wondering about the third-party certification, like where that's at locally versus what the state is doing.
Who's got the best update on that? Mary? Yeah. Any others? Okay. Not seeing any. So now we're going to turn it over to our panel on facilities and what happens to that waste. If we send things to a mixed facility, what actually happens to it? And so we've got three great presentations. We're going to start with Rebecca Jewell from Waste Management, who's going to talk through what happens at their facilities.
Thank you. You put my slides up. Oh, and there's a clicker.
Left, right, laser.
It has a laser. How's it going, folks? I'm Rebecca Jewell, Recycling Program Manager at Davis Street. For those who don't know, Davis Street is down at the end of Davis Street, which is the next exit south from the Oakland Airport. We're in San Leandro. So let's see. So awesome. Okay. So we're situated on a closed landfill. Oh, no. Okay. Okay, yay, look that, he's my hero. Oh, so we're situated on a closed landfill. All in, we're receiving materials from all over the county, as well as some materials coming in from Contra Costa County. It's a Waste Management owned facility. We're a unionized facility with around 300, 280, 260, 310 employees. We have three MRFs on site. One is processing construction and demolition and dry waste. And MSW. One is sorting single stream and one is sorting the public trash. Okay, so there's a map of the facility. 53 acres, as I mentioned, to the right would be the Oyster Bay Park, which is the main body of the closed landfill. And then the MRF in question has a big arrow, so I don't need to figure out how to use this pointer. That thing. So this is, there's been a lot of updates to this MRF. It was originally constructed in 2002, and it's kind of gone through several iterations, especially in the last 24 months. Yes? Oh, my goodness. Sorry. MRF is a material recovery facility. It is essentially a machine the size of a city block designed to put like with like, put cardboard with cardboard, put wood with wood, or paper with paper, or aluminum with aluminum, or whatever. Series of conveyor belts. You've got magnets. You've got a whole bunch of people in there. I would say essentially that it's just based on physics, right? You bring it up to the third floor and you make it fall down when you want it to fall down. So separating by size, weight, different physical properties, et cetera. So this MRF was originally... Oh, says Patrick has a question.
That makes it a cyborg then? It's a combination of people and machines working together?
It is a cyborg. Yes, in some sense. Like it's technology and people. Basically, I would say that if you depend on a machine to do everything, then the machine only sees something like wood, not wood. But it doesn't see good wood versus low-grade wood. Or it sees drywall versus not drywall. It doesn't see painted drywall versus clean drywall. Yes. So there's no John Connors involved in this cyborg adventure. So it's important... For the the Recycling Certification Institute conversation, this MRF is going to be different from Josh and Michael's MRFs because this MRF is designed in part to process straight out trash, right? The folks, their customer whose hand was hovering over a bin thought they were putting it in the trash can. They didn't think they were putting it in a recycling bin. They didn't think it was going to go on to anything. They just thought it was straight out trash. And it's important that we make this distinction because a MRF that sorts only construction debris or only demolition debris or some combination of those put things up and knock things down kind of sorting infrastructure has a different way of measuring success, I would say it that way. Combined around 75 tons an hour of processing capacity. With a goal of 75% diversion, give or take, and we are in the midst of a process with the RCI to be certified, taking this different definitions of success answer into consideration. I got a round of applause from Patrick. We steal my part. So we're processing construction or MSW, municipal solid waste as well, and that is including dry material, bulky waste, meaning that once a year you can call a garbage company and say, I have stuff that's too big to fit into my curbside cart, so that's couches and, you know, you clean out your attic or your basement, that kind of stuff, as well as multifamily trash, so trash from apartment buildings in Oakland. We have a goal for the construction and demolition of processing as little alternative daily cover as possible and the highest diversion possible. The goal for the MSW is to reach the Alameda County standard goals regarding less than 10% readily recyclable materials in the trash. I'm going to just pause here and just think that through with me, right? So one is a measure of how much stuff you got in that went not to the landfill, regardless of the caliber, quality, or quantity of that stuff that went to the landfill. And the other is a measure of what went to the landfill or was destined for the landfill, how much of it was determined as good stuff. So that's kind of a way of describing the different goals of these different processes. So here's a quick overview of the process. We have a bunch of humans on the front of the C&D line. They're grabbing metal, cardboard, and wood. Then it goes through an 8-inch screen, which is, in this case, it's a finger screen, so it's jumping up and down, and the little tinies fall below, and then the bigs fall over the top. The unders, that's when we begin integrating the machinery. And that is sorting magnets that grab out the tin and steel. Then we are grabbing out wood and fine materials. So fines would be defined as like anything about the size of my clicker. So my earrings are in there. My pocket change is in there. My pen is in there, as well as dirt, little pieces of green waste, little pieces of wood, little pieces of dry waste, drywall, like all the littles. Next is, where does this all go? So we have a couple metal recyclers as our neighbor there on Davis Street, so that's where all the metals are going. High-grade wood, which in our definition would be pallets and 2x4s, just clean wood. That's going into our mulch product. Low-grade wood would be wood that is, just not dimensional lumber. So you might think of it as not as IKEA furniture necessarily, but it would be kind of particle board or just somehow treated, but none of the pressure-treated wood that we're not even allowed to accept, in fact. So pressure-treated wood is considered hazmat, and that's, we're not supposed to even get it in, but that's headed for the landfill. The inerts, which we would define as concrete, asphalt, tile, brick, are going into road construction and construction projects on site. And not roads, like, we don't sell this to Caltrans. This is just for low-grade roads. This is low-grade stuff. And then we have, unlike, because we have the goal of capturing all the bottles and cans out of the trash line, we also have infrastructure to grab what you would think of as traditional recycling, right? Bottles, cans, cardboard, and paper. Those are sorted again and sent on to the kind of standard recycling markets. And there is my contact information. Wow. Pretty quick. That was pretty painless. I didn't say much that was really funny, but... Oh,
you're ahead of schedule, so if there's any questions, please. Yeah.
Hey. Okay, so the question for those who are listening to us at home is why David Street doesn't do any salvage? I think that's kind of the essential question. And so one of the important distinctions when thinking about the infrastructure available at, for example, the Berkeley Transfer Station is the Berkeley Transfer Station is designed for about 50,000 people. And the David Street Transfer Station is designed for about 1.5 million. And what that means is that we have so much stuff that we simply cannot, you can't say, like, could I have that piece of wood that's just over there? There isn't, that's not feasible. Second is waste management's a huge corporation and with great big deep pockets. And we have a standard policy that there is no salvage, full stop, end of sentence ever. That has to do with the fact of, you know, every one of our rules has somebody's name on it because they died or got run over, or whatever it is. And in that case, there's some dude's name on it because he was salvaging in the public area and didn't go well. So those are two main reasons. But on a greater question regarding office furniture, I think that's been a phenomenon that's actually been taking place since the dot-com boom and bust, is that this kind of office furniture that we're all using right now is really common in the marketplace, and it's impossible to sell. I mean, if you closed your office today and said to the whole universe, like, I want to go sell this stuff and put it on Craigslist or whatever, like, nobody wants it. You can't even give it away. I mean, I worked in community thrifts before I worked here, and so, like, you go to the St. Vincent de Paul's, they actually won't even take rolling office furniture, like the chairs you're sitting in, because it just doesn't have any market. Sure. Other questions? Oh, come on. Oh, I knew I could count on you, Laurie. Yes, the modifications are finally finished. We've been in ebb and flow since May of last year. We had three separate construction projects. So, yeah. And now it's Tracy, and then we'll go to you. So October 1st, we had our official audit with Dylan, and she was our third-party evaluator. She's got a title. It's an evaluator. And I think we're going through the process. She needs to get a hold of the people to whom I have sold the metal or to whom I have sold the wood, et cetera, and verify. She said, you sent them 2,000 tons of blah, blah, blah. Did you get 2,000 tons of blah, blah, blah from her? And so she needs to get an answer back from all those folks. And, you know, it's just kind of a paperwork intensive process, so we're kind of moving through that, and I think, you know, we have a goal of probably having it all sorted out before the pun intended by the November 1st. You heard it here first. She has things to do. Why are you even here? Seriously. Did you have a question? Thank you for your business.
So, is our debris from a interior demolition value, is that going through that machine?
Right now, let me call my guy. I bet he'll be. No, when your driver says construction and demolition to my scale house operator, that is the open sesame to accessing this newly certified MRF, this MRF that will be certified. And because that MRF is designed in part to sort trash, that means that we don't ask you, we don't make we don't try to make any further comment on whether your definition of construction and demolition meets mine or his or hers or whoever's. That's part of our business model. I'll say it that way. What that percentage means, in fact, it means that 100% of what you brought in came from the same city. That's what that, it says 100%, and what that means is that your driver said, I have construction debris coming from Oakland, and then if your driver needed to say, like, 3% of it or 60% of it came from Emeryville, then it would say 40% from Oakland, 60% from Emeryville. That's what that percentage means. It's really easy to misunderstand. Sorry. Tom?
For you and maybe the other speakers when they come up, I'm just interested in the biomass fuel markets. I would expect that there's more and more engineered wood products replacing conventional lumber that's been going on for a long time. So in the demolition stream, you're going to see more adhesives and glues and other, oriented strand board instead of dimensional lumber or whatever. And if you're separating out even the dimensional lumber for mulch, greater concentration of the engineered wood products going to the biomass market. Do you have any concerns? Do they have any concerns about air emission controls and the long-term viability of those markets for fuel?
So the question is regarding biomass writ large. Let's kind of put it that way. So on the side of, in terms of feedstocks and where it goes, the biomass facilities can be fairly... Well, they blend themselves. So I am not their only source. They're getting whole orchards out of Modesto, and they're getting wood from Michael's place. They're getting wood from all different origins, and they're mixing it themselves on their tipping floor, as it were, as they're grinding or as they're beginning to burn. Second is that it is highly regulated, as one can well imagine, in the state of California. So the air emissions, they're all out in the foothills of the Sierra on the other side of the really terrible air quality management district of this. What's this, San Joaquin? Is that the air quality? They're out of that. So they're somewhat sheltered. But Michael just brought up this morning AB 290, which suggests that the biomass markets are threatened. And so I would say from a threats perspective, it's coming in two directions. The first is that without biomass, there is no outlet for the wood, for many streams of wood. And that means then that the diversion rates will go down. Because a large percentage of the diversion that is potential in a C&D load is coming from wood, depending, right? Are you in an industrial building facility? Or like, are you processing industrial, like, concrete tilt-ups? Are you processing demolition or construction debris from new housing development, for example? So that's a threat. And when any given jurisdiction or any given definition of diversion does or doesn't include biomass, the concern is then, well, what else should we do with it? And if the answer is landfill, okay, that's fine. That is to say, I mean, I don't think it's fine, but I suppose as the alternative, which is worse, I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to have the answer to that question. But I think that all the cities should be should recognize that the biomass is a large portion of your diversion for your programs. And if you're looking at just a net diversion, and then you want to cut it a little bit more closely and say diversion without ADC, and then you want to cut it closer and say it's a net diversion without ADC and without burning, like, okay, now you're going to end up at like 2%. Oh, that's my cue. Sorry, I've just been hooked off.
Thank you. Good.
Hi, I'm Michael. I'm the Director of Sustainability at Zanker Recycling, and I wanted to answer two questions before I get onto my presentation. This chair. We're going to recycle this chair for you. You're welcome. I just don't know how I'm going to do it. Because this chair is made from 7 different types of plastics. I technically have to rip this thing apart, take the foam out here, take the foam out here. That's 2 or 3, 4, another one, 5. Down here on the feet are 6. And I got a little bit of metal in there, too. Yay, I make some money on metal. These are becoming impossible to deal with. Just like this table, this is actually 8 different products. So as a recycler, looking at a material going, I can recycle wood. Hey, that's one product. Maybe there's some contamination. Maybe there's some pressure-treated lumber in it or creosote. Well, that's easy to pull out, and we don't want it. And it's easy to get out of there and make our mulches and make our biomass fuel and stuff. But something like this, way, way past our pay grade. This is difficult stuff. And this is the challenge that the industry, our whole recycling industry, is going to have in the future. Because we're going to need to start doing stuff with these type of materials. It's going to happen. Second, biomass. Just to finish up real fast. There's 24 biomass plants in the state of California. There were 56 at one point developed in the 1970s to treat ag waste, keep all the smoke out of all the cities. And number two is all the forestry waste. Forestry has gone down. Ag waste is still there. But urban waste, lumber, is still a huge part. It's over 50% of the amount of materials that these biomass take. And these biomass facilities take really, really clean material. There might be a little piece of plastic. They don't want that because they have air emissions they have to deal with, the ash content they have to deal with. And what's happening in the now, as we speak, more of these plants are closing. But we want to recycle more. So what we're going to be seeing as an industry, give you a heads up, is you're going to see a huge increase in tipping fees. Because right now we make money when we sell biomass. We're going to have to start paying money to get rid of the materials. And that's really coming down the road here within the next year. So stay tuned. All right. Sorry about that. That was doom and gloom. I'm depressed. Okay. Zanka Recycling, we're located in San Jose. And let's see here. We actually have 2 facilities in San Jose right here that are doing C&D recycling. We have the Zanker Road Landfill that is not a landfill, and we have the Zanker Materials Processing Facility that is a landfill. I know, I'm screwed up, but that's okay. We also have another facility right here that does dry anaerobic digestion of food scraps, but I'm not here to talk about that. What I am here to talk about is C&D, and we're going to go ahead and click that on. Instead of me trying to yap and bore all you guys, we're going to let one of my staff do that. This is a little video we have on YouTube. All our stuff, by the way, can be found on YouTube because it's easier to show you this than try to talk about it. Hit it.
Zanker Materials Processing Facility specializes in construction wastes. Material enters the site from contractors, debris boxes, and homeowners. All incoming materials are weighted and recorded and directed to our tipping area. There, a load checker will direct you to where you tip your materials. Your materials are tipped in an asphalt pad area where a load checker will grade your material. He may even take a photo of the load for documentation. At the Zanker Material Processing Facility, we have the capability of processing 180,000 tons of construction waste per year through our construction waste sorting system. This system is used to remove up to 16 different commodities. We first utilize a CAT excavator to manicure the loads, while another CAT excavator carefully loads the in-feed conveyor system. These materials then travel to a screening system, where the smaller materials, less than 8 inches in size, are removed for further processing. Materials larger than 8 inches, or the overs we'll call them, are conveyed to the manual.
Josh is going to demonstrate on that. So, there you go. A little further back. There you go. Perfect.
Or the overs we'll call them, are conveyed to the manual sort line where they are sorted using hand labor. The C&D sort line uses 22 employees to process up to 65 tons of material per hour with an average recycling rate of 85%. As employees recover the recyclable commodities, each material is dropped in a bunker below, which can be easily removed by one of our loaders. Each employee is responsible for removing up to 3 commodities, therefore allowing redundancy in our system if a material is missed by one of the previous sorters. The recovered material is then routed for additional site processing or loaded and hauled to approved recyclers. This system dramatically improved processing operations as sorters were no longer ground sorting narrow vehicles and trucks. Residual materials from the sorting operations are then loaded into transfer trucks and sent to an area landfill for disposal. The smaller materials from the screening system near the beginning of the sort line are then conveyed to a debris roll screen, where the smaller 3-inch minus materials are removed. The larger materials are then processed through a knee-hot air separator that divides the material by density. The diverted material falls into very large bunkers underneath the sort line. These materials are then sent to approved recyclers throughout the state or sent to Zinker Road Landfill, Site 1, for processing. In 2014, the facility processed 180,000 tons of material. The smaller materials from the debris roll screen, which are less than 3-inch minus, are then conveyed to a trommel screen that removes smaller particles, mainly sheetrock. This product is then loaded onto trucks and transported to the agriculture industry for reuse. The remaining products are then processed using a knee-hot air separator that separates the material by density. The remaining material from the knee-hot are conveyed to a stockpile and shipped to another landfill for use as an alternative daily cover. If you would like more information regarding our recycling services at our Zinker Material Processing Facility, please visit our website at www.zinkerrecycling.com.
Okay, so that's our construction waste processing, stuff you put in a debris box. We break up things that come into our site by categories. So we have our clean separation of wood. So our wood recycling, our sheetrock recycling, our asphalt shingle recycling. Then we have also our concrete, which we're not going to show you a video on that. But we also have our demolition. So you tear down a house, you tear down a building. It comes through an entire different operation because, in reality, it's completely different material. When you tear this building down, you're going to have lots of concrete, a little sheetrock too. You're going to have some carpet. You're going to have some drapes, some fabric, some ceiling tiles, lots of metals. But fundamentally, this is concrete building. You wouldn't put it through that plant. You'd destroy that plant. You'd want to put that concrete through a concrete recycling operation. But if you got more of a wood structure, like a house or a wood-framed warehouse or something, that could go through something different, a different type of piece of equipment. And that's our next one.
In 1987, Zinker developed the first demolition recycling operation in the United States. This system was quickly replaced in 1989 by a unique water bath demolition operation, which was built and operational 2 months prior to the Loma Prieta earthquake. In 1997, Zinker developed a unique float tank and screening system we called the Rocket that separates the soil, mixed concrete, and wood components from the demolition debris. Today, Zinker Recycling operates a new 75-ton per hour demolition debris processing operation that is capable of increasing our recycling rate while reducing our operational costs. Our typical demolition debris is a wood-structured building that is mechanically crushed and loaded in a high-side trailer. These trailers are brought to the Zinker facility where they are weighted and recorded at our scale house. From the scale house, the material is dumped into the tipping area of our new demolition recycling operation. Prior to loading the in-feed conveyor, a CAT excavator will remove large pieces of metal, concrete, and non-recyclable products such as carpeting and fabric. The operator will then load the in-feed conveyor that will transport the materials into a large finger screen that removes the 5-inch minus fraction materials. The larger materials pass over the screen and head up to a sorting station, where concrete, metal, and residuals are removed. The remaining materials on the sort line is lumber, which is directed to Zinker's wood recycling operations. The smaller fraction from the large finger screen 5-inch minus materials then travel up a conveyor past a magnet that removes ferrous metals, and into a debris roll screen, which removes the 2-inch minus fraction. The material is then transported to a stockpile, where they are shipped to another landfill to use as cover material. The larger fraction of materials from the debris roll screen, mainly wood waste and concrete, are then conveyed into 2 knee-hot air systems that separates the material by density. The lighter material from the separation, usually wood waste, falls on another conveyor and in front of sorting stations, where employees remove contamination such as plastics. The heavier materials, mainly concrete, fall on a sorting conveyor. This conveyor passes in front of an employee who removes non-wanted items, thus the concrete is clean enough to be used in our base rock production. This system processes over 75 tons per hour with a 90% recycling rate and is one of the key reasons Zanker remains the best recycler in California.
Okay, so I could do 3 minutes. So those are the videos that are on our site. We have also, you know, how to come to Zanker, because we people don't go to landfill very often. So how to do that. Here's a photo of our wood waste recycling operation that we have on our site. Here's our concrete recycling. Here's some asphalt shingles. Josh will be talking about that. But more importantly, it's our certification. And we are third-party certified by Recycling Certification Institute. My numbers are on my website. They change every month, and you can see what they are. I wish they were higher. I wish for a lot of things. But you see my number with ADC and without ADC, and it depends on what city we're talking about. I'm all about third-party certification. Yes, I'm on the board of CDRA, the Construction and Demolition Recycling Association. And all I want is everybody to be on a level playing field. When I do something like this, the investment that you saw with those two little videos represents around $13 or $14 million. I want to be able to be treated the same way that a guy that's in a back alley dumping it on the ground, and he's got a higher recycling rate than me. How is that really possible? Well, it's not. He has a better eraser than I do. But this is what our recycling rates have happened here recently. You know, I was up in the 80s. Well, became certified. I got to 70%, and I'm now at 73.25. And that's for my C&D operation. You know, I wish it was better. But once again, we have to grade every load that comes in. And when we do, we grade them separately. We have a guy out there. He's taking a load at the look at the load. Yeah, that's construction waste. See this one right here? This is construction waste, right? Wrong. This is trash. What am I going to do with this? It's painted wood doors. It's going to go in the landfill. There's no market for that material. That carpet right there, ain't going to work. The rest of the stuff is all painted, pressed wood. There are no markets for that. If I was to tell you, hey, I'm going to recycle that, I'd be lying to you. No market. I can't recycle that. Here's another. Perfect. Another 0% diversion rate. Trash. Everybody calls it C&D. This one here is 0% for one reason. All those bags, I don't open bags. You open bags, you find things like glass and nails, and you get workers' comp issues. We don't open bags in this operation. This one here, this is a 50%. Pretty good load. You know, we got some ceiling tiles, some insulation. Ceiling tiles really are our worst enemy at this point because it looks just like sheetrock. Here's another 50% one. There's a lot of trash mixed in those loads. Lots of great pallets and cardboard, though. But every load that comes in gets graded. So when we look at the world, it's not just C&D. We look at the world as construction waste, demolition debris, and trash. And that's about it for my time.
Josh, you're up. And apologies for, I mean, please hold your questions at the end over lunch. We'll have time. We're trying to get through a lot of content here, so you're up next.
All right. I'm Josh Folks. I'm with Commercial Waste and Recycling. We're in Oakland, so we're the little guy down there by the Coliseum. In fact, I look at some of the presentations, and $17 million and $13 million. I think I've spent a couple between what we've started. But we're kind of, I like the way that Rebecca described it. We're the boutique C&D recycler. So we're open Monday through Friday, 6 to 6, and Saturday, 7:30 to 4:30. We're right by the Coliseum, being there, which is great because I get to walk to the A's games. Not a fancy flyover, but real quick, the way that our facility works is cars come in across our scale here, and that's where we'll identify the loads coming in. And ours are pretty simple. It's either mixed C&D, or it's clean green waste, or clean wood. All of our mixed C&D loads do at this time include all of the garbage loads. So when we're processing those mixed loads, it's everything that's C&D related, anything non-hazardous, I should say. So it's identified. The guys curl around, and they come into here, and then they unload C&D on this side of the yard and green waste over here on this side of the yard. All the blonde wood and clean, you know, all the clean wood gets pushed over to this side, and they run it through this big grinder, and we make our biomass. Any of the C&D commodity items, like sheetrock, like asphalt shingles, like concrete, cardboard, plastic, metal. There was at one point carpet. That's no longer there anymore. That's an older picture. But the carpet markets have gone away. And I think there's actually a telling story with some of the both presenters before me is a lot of our end market, or a lot of our ability to recycle is driven by what the end market actually is. With the changes coming along with the power plant situation, and us, we're going to be losing a handful of power plants. It's going to be fewer, burning in the next few months. Actually, that's going to eliminate some of those markets for us. Quick look at, you know, there's the guy on the scaling out. There's some of the bins that we sort into, and it's a real rough and dirty, you know, hands-on floor sort. And guys are going to throw material into the bins. The forklifts are going to take them to the different piles and rotate them out into those piles. Guys, in addition to the scale operator checking out the loads, our operators here will check a load coming in, make sure we're reducing the amount of things we're not supposed to take. And it's all the liquid materials. We don't want any paints. We don't want any chemicals. We don't want any hazardous material. We don't want your, medical waste container stuff full of needles and things of that. You know, we're a C&D facility. That's all we want to touch. And we reject a lot of material that people try to sneak into loads. Like I said, rough and dirty, guys throwing concrete, and we'll push that over to the concrete pile, more hand sorting. We do get the big guys involved to push it around into the other piles, and I'll show you what some of those look like here in a minute. This would be an ADC feedstock. We don't have the means to separate the paper from the wood tear off, so that's going to go into an ADC feedstock side. Over on this side, that's my garbage pile. A lot of carpet now. Some lighter items, when we get really, really busy, becomes a priority of weight. If we get bamboozled in a rush time, we will try to push piles to the side so we can go through them later. Otherwise, some of the lighter plastics or some of the cardboards are going to get through our system and go off to the landfill as garbage. There's another view of the ADC feedstock, some metal over there. That's the ADC when it's done, once it goes through that same shredder that I showed you from the aerial shot. Some shingles, some inerts, foam pad, carpet pad. That goes to a local market. Or there's a local guy who comes and picks it up, I should say. It actually goes overseas. More metal. Mattresses. We actually do a fair amount of mattresses. Last year, this time, we did 1,856 mattresses. This year, 2,000 mattresses have come through our facility. Green waste is the other thing that we do. So a lot of wood gets mixed in with our green waste. We blend it together. It goes through the crambo and comes out as biomass on the other side, or biofuel, we'll call it. We did 14,000 tons last 12 months. Of green waste material, we added to that what we calculate as 2,500 tons of wood that came out of our C&D sorting through the last 12 months. This would also include clean wood as it comes in. It goes straight over to that. We don't classify it as C&D. There it goes through the shredder, and it comes out of the shredder, and there's the resulting pile, and off it goes. So last year, our little facility... through September 1st. We did 35,000 tons of C&D at our facility with another 14,000 tons of green waste and clean wood waste coming in. Another plug for the RCI. We're not yet certified. We're just getting ready to start that process with Stephen, and we'll probably get a call from you at some stage of the game, it looks like. There's some of our numbers, and you guys are welcome to go look at that. We do have a lot of ADC. I mean, that's an admitted need for diversion at this point in the materials that we're dealing with. Michael pointed out painted wood. You show me a market for painted wood, I'm happy to get there. There is no market for it at this stage. We resize and get it, and that's going to be the larger component of that number, is that 18,000 tons of the 35 that came in. So including ADC, we're about 75% roughly as a diversion number. True recycling without the ADC, I'd put us probably in that 25, low 20s to maybe mid to high 20% range. It's a marked difference. It really is. And that's us in a nutshell. Here's my number. Any questions? Or I guess no, save questions.
No.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you.
I
think we have time for questions for Josh and then also for the rest of the room.
Okay.
I'm going to make a point about ADC. From the city's perspective, from your requirements, and how do you keep... So the goal is to keep people from taking raw construction and really grinding it up and putting it on the floor.
Right.
That's the goal. Just don't do that, right?
Right.
If your regulation were to say instead of keeping, saying that ADC doesn't count, but rather to say that you're not allowed to bring material to a facility that creates ADC out of unsorted C&D, that would be a way to make it such that we reduce the amount of alternative daily cover from unsorted C&D. That's the goal, right? You don't want that sidewalk pieces go into alternative daily cover. You don't want good 2x4s going into ADC, because they were already fine. They could have gone and done something else useful. But for your roof tear-offs, what the hell else are you going to do with it? Exactly. So the goal would be such that, sure, grind it up and find something else to do with it. That's great. But don't grind raw C&D. I would use that as, and that would be a way I think that cities should structure your construction ordinances to keep the material from going out to facilities where they're just grinding and ADC-ing. Just like if it's just it's straight, if you took the contents of a truck, throw it on the ground and pick it up and put it into a shredder and use the result for alternative daily cover, I think that's what we don't want to have happen. We need it to go through some kind of a sort such that we've done some level, I mean, and then we could decide what our level is that we need, that the market will bear, but in terms of some level of sorting to capture the things that we want captured. Maybe we say we don't want biomass, in which case we don't want treated wood to be captured. We want it to go to ADC or we want it to go to the landfill. We don't want carpet captured because we can't do it, figure out what to do with it. But we do want metal. We do want cardboard. We do want concrete. We do want asphalt. We want all of those things captured. So if the ordinance simply said, you must send it to a facility that sorts first, and after that, it's a little bit kind of like the stop waste definition of like success, which is just look at the outputs. Don't look at the inputs. So RCI, no, it's the same definition that everybody else is using, which is what percentage of your material is going to ADC. Yeah, regardless of your pre-processing. No, but you could write your C&D ordinance simply to say that you just say simply that your material cannot go to a facility that grinds before sorts. By calling and asking the salesperson. Dylan has an
opinion. Well, I was just going to mention
the audience at home.
Oh,
Okay. I was just going to say that I agree with the concept and intent of what Rebecca is saying, but the other complicating factor is the state regulations for landfill defines alternative daily cover as basically construction and demolition materials, period. So part of the problem is our state regulations that don't make that definition or distinction between a recyclable or reusable C&D material versus not.
Many cities now refer to Cal Green for their C&D recycling requirements and do no longer refer to their ordinance because Cal Green is becoming more and more stringent than perhaps a city C&D ordinance. So I think the majority of cities, I don't know for a fact, but many refer to Cal Green now. So it's just something to keep in mind.
And Marcy, to your point, RCI is still a voluntary program, so if someone's going to go through and get that certification and all they're doing is grinding things up and applying it at EDC, they probably won't want to seek that label now, right?
To make a point to that, I'm exposing a heel when I do that. I know that ADC is frowned on by some municipalities, but at the same time, I think there has to be enough of an industry participation that says, we do want that level playing field. We do want everybody speaking the same language, as long as some of those nuances when it comes out can be, and I think some of those may be problems for me at this point with a large amount of ADC, you know, if that becomes the norm for other processes, not necessarily the norm, but it's well understood that these guys aren't just cooking numbers. Because let's face it, C&D processors have cooked numbers for so many times. That's why we're talking about third-party certification. That's why we're talking about a level playing field. I don't want to be that guy. If you don't like ADC as an option, I'm not going to lie to you and tell you that I'm not doing ADC. There it is. I'd rather you know who I am and trust that when I'm going through the process, we're doing the best that we can. That's one of my most expensive piles. It's garbage is my most expensive pile. ADC is my next most expensive pile, short of hazmat when I have to deal with that. But there's economic reasons for me not to go to landfill or ADC. It comes out of my pocket when it goes to that material stream. So I'm doing everything I can to get it out of that pile. So that being the effort, if that's not a good enough effort for some municipalities, that's the best I can do at this stage of the game. But, you know, I'd rather be transparent, have that level playing field, and everybody's speaking the same language when we talk what is C&D, what's ADC, what's recycled, what's diversion, you know, all those trick words that people, we're 90% recycling, but they're diversion, and then even then it's sketchy. So, you know, I don't want to be that guy. I'm trying to, you know, maybe have a $17 million sort line at some point in the time. I don't, you know.
It's good to dream.
Yes, exactly.
You just need shareholders to get that.
Any other last questions for this panel?
So we turn away. The number of contaminated loads, and contamination being pressure-treated, creosote-treated lumber, has waste, as in paint. In some cases, it's very, very minute. It doesn't happen very often you get full loads of something. It's usually there's something bad in a load. And in our case, every one of our loads are low checked, so we have guys standing there looking at stuff. And so when we see that full can of paint, we give it back to them. Said, "Here's the phone number. We got a little slip. Here's the phone number for household hazardous waste. Bring it there. It's not our problem. It's your problem, but it's a very, very small percentage."
Eric's actually asking the question about how many customers come in and say that's C&D, and you say, "I beg to differ."
So that's probably now about 3 or 4%, and it's pure definition. And if you want me to recycle your insulation, your vinyl flooring, your wet carpeting, your wet ceiling tile, you're coming to the wrong guy.
perfect segue for our next panel, which is how do you get those loads in as best condition as you can for the places you send them to, which is our contractor panel. I'm going to ask Emily to come up and present about GCI. Yes, yes. Little transition.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Left, right, laser. Don't hit that. That's a stop. So Emily's with GCI Construction. I don't have your full bio, but you guys do some amazing stuff on green building, LEED, living building, and she's going to share some of the best practices that they've implemented.
Thank you, Wes. Good morning, everyone. So I'm Emily. I'm the sustainability manager for GCI General Contractors. We're a commercial firm based in San Francisco, Silicon Valley, and South San Francisco. And construction waste is a big part of my job, and I'm going to delve into the steps it takes to achieve a higher diversion rate. So first and foremost is communication amongst your team members. You have to start the conversations early on, way before demo. This includes the owner, the project manager, superintendent, subcontractors, laborers, sustainability manager, your hauler, your waste facility, your city recycling specialist. And I just wanted to say Keith James is here. He's one of our superintendents. And he does a kick-ass job on the construction site, like setting it up, all the waste bins, and everything we need. So thank you, Keith. Second, you need to do a lot of research on city and state requirements and any green building certification requirements. This is the CalGreen, as we already discussed that with Wes. But you just need to check what the minimum waste diversion requirements are, and if you're already going for a high diversion rate, you're going to go past those goals anyway. So, and this is city ordinances that you want to research. And after you do your research, you want to talk to your city recycling specialist, your waste hauler, and your facility, and let them know that you're going for a really high diversion rate. And they'll help you the best that they can, give you advice and tips on how to make that happen. And you want to set up a great implementation action plan. So this is an example of a waste log that's set up on site. And you just want to have your laborers, subcontractors, or haulers fill it out. Let's see. You want to say whether or not you have a photo of the waste. Oops. Uh-oh. Did I press wrong? Okay. You want... Why? I don't know why it's doing that. Anyway. There's columns of, oops, okay. Well, you want to take photos. You want to list where it's going, who hauled it, what the date was. You want to keep your recycling receipts. And if you can, you know, keep that a digital copy of everything on your computer so that when you do fill out, when you calculate your diversion rate, you have all that proof of what went where and what the rate was.
Is this the list that Living Building Challenge requires?
No, well, it is, but I actually made that for our projects to go on site, just so we could keep track of what's going out. Oop. No, why is it? Okay. Do I go right or left now? Oh, this is another example of a recycling haul-off log. So however you want to make it and set it up on your job site, it's up to you, depending on the parameters. So I guess I go the opposite direction now. You want to source, separate, and salvage as much as you can. This is an example of our waste signs that go on the bins. And you want to have a bin for each item and make sure that your subcontractors are trained, your super's trained. You want to have a meeting beforehand, before demo, get everyone on board. And you should go to the site often and check to see that everything's going smoothly. And we, most of the time, have a laborer on site who will actually dig through the bins and pull out any items that don't belong in the bins to create a single stream. And these are examples of our donation receipts. Just another way to keep track of what is going into your diversion rate. And this also adds to your diversion rate. It makes it higher, whatever you salvage and donate. And this is an example of a project we did in San Francisco that was a Living Building Challenge project. Keith and I worked on this project, and we got about 96%, and we were really proud of that. I think I missed a slide, but that's okay. I was going to say the last thing is, be patient and be precise. Keep being diligent about the waste diversion throughout the whole project. Don't just start out excited and then let it fizzle out. You have to keep it running smoothly. Thank you.
I have a couple extra questions for you. So mostly you guys deal with tenant improvements projects, is that true? And what kind of unique things do you think come out of trying to divert a lot of waste from those types of projects as opposed to maybe a new construction? Are there any tips or tricks?
I'm not sure is compared to new. I mean, I think just the relationships you build with the donation sites and people you work with. They appreciate, like, for example, carpet tile. Habitat for Humanity loves carpet tile. I call them up every time we have a demo, and they take all of our carpet tile, and they donate it to new homes. Just building a relationship with there's building resources, scrap. I mean, here in the Bay Area, we're very blessed to have all these different facilities that will actually take the donations and the waste. And we have great C&D facilities as well. So, any questions? Go ahead. Yeah.
When you make a donation, are you something to be weighed, or how are you calculating the volume amount?
That's a good question. It's not always weighed. You can estimate the weight. Yeah. It is possible. We have small toter bins that are emptied more frequently than larger bins. There's a nominal cost, I think. Probably the expense goes into the laborers who are working on site to sort through all the bins.
So you mentioned you have to do a lot of research for each city.
Yeah. That's a great question. I would say just have a really great construction waste management site up with links to any information that they would need. I had some slides up here. I did create a construction waste management. For some reason, it didn't show up, but one more. I think the one before that one. This one. Maybe this one. That's a good here's an example of a few pages on the construction waste management site. But I'll create a hyperlink to I'll talk about the facility, the material, and then how it's supposed to be set up on site. So hopefully, if they go to that site or the city site, it'll have the information that the superintendent needs or the subcontractors need to do a good job for waste diversion. So I think the more information, the better. Oh, yeah, we do Green Hill. Uh-huh. And some cities require that now, like Palo Alto. They require for tenant improvements over a certain square footage to do Tier 1 of CalGreen. So right off the bat, you have to do Tier 1, which is 65% waste diversion. And you have to put everything on Green Halo. So it depends on the city. Is there any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Michael Strong with PanCal Construction. And Michael's been doing this for quite a while and is going to share some experiences on projects.
Hey, Wes, thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. A room full of city officials. There's a lot I would love to talk to you about right now, but Wes assured me it wouldn't be appropriate, so I'll try to stick to the subject at hand. But at least I know no one's answering their phone in their offices because you're out getting continuing education. So that's a good thing. Thanks for being here, and thanks for listening to a builder perspective on what we've got here. I couldn't help but kind of go old school with the slide. It's the fall, the seasons are turning, so I thought I'd put some pretty leaves up there that we could take a look at, and then you'll see in the slides ahead, you know, they'll be juxtaposed against trashy landfill sites or sorting facilities. But we just have a couple slides to go through, but the subject matter, I think, is really important. And having the builder's perspective, I appreciate the opportunity. So I'm not here to offend anybody, but I am here to challenge everybody, including the other speakers today, because this is really hard to do. This is not as pretty as a slideshow. It's tough. And I've been the beneficiary personally, and my company and the companies I have worked for have been the beneficiary of uncertified recycling facilities from Hawaii to California, from Texas to the Carolinas. And we've benefited from numbers that we knew going in weren't real. It's a joke. You know, it is so nice to see the industry going the direction it is, the nonprofit organizations whose programs we're trying to follow and getting certified, giving bonuses, bonus points for going to the facilities that our previous round of speakers are trying to build to serve our industry and to serve the communities that we live in. Because the other numbers, they're not real, as you already heard. But, you know, as a builder, I can assure you that's the case. Those numbers are false. So, you know, stop waste. Any part of this we do not understand. No, of course not. Right? What we do with the waste that we can't stop is really where the conversation goes from here. And so we're just going to take a look at three things, real briefly the first two, and then I want to spend as much time as I possibly can on job site realities, on my own experience in job site realities. So depending on who you talk to, just a couple of random facts that are out there in terms of how much waste is there. 10 to 15% of all construction materials are waste. So 10 to 15% of everything that shows up on the job site that's supposed to go into the structure that's being built is going to end up being trash in one form or another. For some of you, that number means something. Wow, I didn't know it was that low. Oh my gosh, I didn't know it was that high. I promise you, if you were the one cutting the check for that, your reaction would be, oh my gosh, wouldn't I love a 15% raise this year? Imagine if I had 15% bleeding out of my W-2, right? Look at your W-2. Pay stub right now and just put another deduction on there that says 15% slippage. That number is really big then, isn't it? So 10 to 15% is a lot. Enough lumber to frame 2,000 plus single family homes annually. This isn't provided by Greenpeace. This isn't provided by Stop Waste. This is provided by the National Association of Home Builders, not America's leading environmental resource. Okay? And they're saying their members, of which I am one, waste enough lumber annually that we could frame over 2,000 homes. 10 to 12% simply cardboard. Waste from construction accounts for up to 40% of the nation's solid waste. The experts that spoke in the first round probably know exactly what that number is. And 8,000 pounds of waste is created from construction of a 2,000 square foot home, also courtesy of the National Association of Home Builders. So as we move to the second slide here about who cares? Who cares? I really want to take the perspective of the boots on the ground. So despite the fact that I'm not wearing boots, I had boots on this morning at 5:05 when I showed up at the job site, and a hard hat and a safety vest and all the other rigmarole that I need to protect myself working on a job site. So the assumption is that the boots on the ground don't care. So that they do care. So let's kind of play with that for a moment. So we've got the craftsperson, right? We've got the individual on his hands and knees or her hands and knees right now installing tile at War Memorial's Veterans Building in San Francisco, right? We've got Joe at one end of the hallway, and we've got Jose at the other. And the assumption that we're working on is that they care and that their labor foreman cares about what happens to the waste and that the superintendent and project manager for that subcontractor also care. And then, of course, you've got the building contractor, in this case, Panco, right? Our field engineer cares, our assistant superintendent, project manager, and the individual sponsor. So what are we up to? We're up to maybe 10 people now that care. Depending on the project, 3 to 6 design team members. Of course, they care. 3 to 6 city inspectors. 3 to 6 special inspectors. And the client and the tenant. So depending on the project and how we move these numbers around, we're up to about 30 people that care. That's the assumption that we're working under, right? I'm here to tell you my reality is that none of these people care, or that only really a couple of them care. That craftsperson just drove 2 hours one way to get to that job site. Recycling their construction waste is not preeminent on their mind. That is not the reality of what's going on out there. And their boss, it's not that they don't care, right? We know this, folks. We all care. But at work, that's not our priority. That's not our priority. I worked my way through college doing construction through an undergraduate and 2 graduate degrees. So I consider myself a pretty well-educated guy. And I'm looking at a room of white-collar, pretty well-educated people. Right? And I know construction. And I walked up this morning, and I went straight to those 3 trash cans with trash I had in my pocket, and it's like, why doesn't my trash ever match the trash on those photographs? It never does. I'm just like, and I forgot my glasses. Is that an aluminum can, or is that a plastic bottle? I don't know, you know, and it sucks. It's frustrating. And then I finally get something that I understand, which is a napkin, and it's like, okay, is this going to go compost? You know, maybe if I lick it, I can put it in the compost, but maybe it's dry enough that it should go in recycling. Compost. And what if Wes is watching and I get it wrong? In this place, I've got a wet napkin in my back pocket right now, right? That's me with you here in this topic. If we all pulled trash out of our cars, and I had this happen to me very recently, and stood up and held up various pieces of trash and said, which one of these does it go into? You don't want to know how many of you would get how many of those wrong. It was embarrassing to everybody in the room. And that's us, well-educated, experienced people, the choir who scream and live and breathe this stuff. And now we're talking about Joe and Jose, who just drove 2 hours to the job site, and we really think they care? Let me tell you what their reality is. Let me tell you what their reality is. They drive 2 hours. That's not unusual, right? I have another superintendent in the room. It's not unusual. This is not unusual. 2 hours one way to get to the job site. And when they get to the job site, the place that they've always parked, it's closed. They can't get into the parking lot. They didn't know that. No one told them that. The sign didn't get put up. So they drive around the block a couple more times. And now they're further away from the job site, and they've got to lug their tools and equipment and their material and hope their car doesn't get broken into. And then they finally get up to the job site, and the entrance to the job site that they normally go into has changed because the builder didn't tell the subcontractor, and the subcontractor PM didn't tell the superintendent, and the superintendent didn't tell the foreman, and the foreman didn't tell the craftsperson. And so then they finally get on site, and they go through security, and they walk up to the freight elevator that is what? It's not working. The individual who operates it showed up late. It's shut down. It's been relocated. And they got to figure out a new way to get to the 6th floor. with all their tools and their materials and their equipment. Or they get up to the sixth floor where they left their tools and their material and their equipment, and the power's not working. Why? How can this be? Because this is a job site. This is what happens. Power goes out on us all the time. Right? And their tools are stolen. Or they're damaged. Or they get all set up and they've got a red tag. Or the builder hasn't told them this. Or the designer hasn't told them that. And they've got to move to another floor and something hasn't been approved. Imagine if that was your reality. Imagine if every day you drove up and you had your CPU and your computer monitor and your blueprints and all your plans, and some of you may, and your parking lot was closed and no one told you about it. And you had to drive around, you finally get into the parking lot, you finally get to the building, and your building entrance was closed, and your elevator wasn't working. And then you went upstairs to your office, and you went to brew yourself a tea, and you're like, the tea bag goes in the green container. I know this. Where's the green container? Who moved the green container? Now the green container's been moved. These 12, 15, 16 containers that we have on job sites, most job sites can't accommodate very large containers, so you're dealing with small containers, so you're dealing with a lot of labor to empty those things all the time and to move those around all the time. Imagine if in your office, imagine, Wes, every day you came in and someone moved the recycling. People would be like sitting down and saying, you know, can we talk about this, please? This is not very efficient. But that's the reality of what's going on out there in the field. That's what we have to deal with out there in the field every day. So when we talk about who cares, I beg to differ that either one of these two individuals care about that. They care about safety. They care about quality. They compare about one of you red tagging their work. They care about getting paid. This is not high up on the list. So, I still have a couple minutes, right? So, the most recent PANCO project that I was on was West Oakland, Vincent Academy, Net Zero Energy Ready Public Charter School. Ideal conditions from a materials recycling perspective, because I had enough room to put up 10 dumpsters. Eric's been out there. He's seen it. At least for 20 minutes, I could keep 10 dumpsters out there, and then things change and they move, and you have to move those all around. And my project manager, she said, hey, we're gonna do, you know, the 20 dumpster thing, right? This is where we're going to put this material and this material and this material and this material and this material. And I was like, no. She says, why? And I said, because I don't care. I mean, I don't. In the big picture, this is not the low-hanging fruit. I live about context being everything, right? I got way too much to worry about. She's like, well, we're going to get a higher diversion rate. I said, yeah, you will. I won't argue with that. Absolutely, positively, 10 dumpsters for 10 materials gives you 10 higher diversion rates. And there's not a recycler in the room that will argue with that. Right? But if you want participation, then you make it easy. Right? You make it simple. And you put one dumpster out there, one big, fat dumpster out there. And you change that out. And that's where these guys are more focused. They're more focused on the safety. They're more focused on everything else. You reduce, and I hate to play the contrarian here, but you reduce the amount of dumpsters you have out there. You don't expand them. The money and the time that we wasted sorting trash on that job site with somebody who does care. I mean, I was a Weeblo. I was a Boy Scout. I recycled, right? Built one of the first 100 lead pilot homes in the country. I get this stuff, and I understand. And I was in that dumpster. I lived in these dumpsters for 8 months. And I taught, 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 and I taught. And I didn't make a bit of difference. From Houston, we had no recycling, residential recycling program in the country. And the city started single-stream recycling, and the line at City Hall was blocks long of people who wanted it. So we can sit here and we can say, yes, single stream gives us higher diversion rates. Or we say, no, let's put one box out there and get it all recycled. The recycling rates went through the roof. People wanted those things because we made it easy. We didn't have college-educated people standing here in anxiety going, where do I put this stupid thing? Let alone a probably less educated laborer in the field. If I can't figure it out, what's this into those poor guys, man? And we moved these things. It was tough. It was tough. So I'm here to take a semi-contrarian position, and it's not a lazy position. It's not that we don't mind doing the work. It's just that it's not a good use of our resources. The money and the time that we spent over there trying to get the trash in the right place to begin with and then to climb in and pull it out and put it back in, I can tell you this. I can tell that what that was to Wes and say, you know what, Wes? How about if instead on the next job, we just cut you a $15,000 donation? And wouldn't you love to see how that conversation goes, right? Because that's probably what it cost. Where are our dollars better spent is the perspective that this builder is taking on our job sites. And, you know, Panco has done every level of LEED, Living Building Challenge, Net Zero Energy. We're a company who gets it, and we want to get it. But I'm kind of playing within the organization that alternate, you know, speaking from an alternate universe in the field, from an educated, experienced alternate universe in the field that says, I don't think this is the best way we should go about it. So as I stated at the beginning of my presentation, I'm not here to offend. I'm here to challenge. I want us all to think about this stuff. But at a minimum, these certified facilities are an imperative. So thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you. You know, this is who read the New York Times article about the reign of recycling maybe being over? You're bringing up some really important points that have been hitting the recycling industry about, is it better to get everything in one bin and sort it? You get lower quality, but you get bigger volume, and as opposed to source separation where you get higher quality but probably less participation. And we just saw two kind of very different ways to do this on job sites, which I think is fascinating, right? You've got kind of, Michael, you made some really good points. Emily, you also showed that it doesn't have to be super difficult or on certain project types or certain project goals. It is an objective. So I wondered if there was anything you wanted to say about what you've heard or anybody else in the audience, too. We have a little bit of time here. But I think it's just fascinating the way the dichotomy we just saw.
I loved your presentation, and I thought you brought up some great points, and it made me think. I think you build from the ground up, correct?
We do.
Yeah. So we do tenant improvements, and I think they're different in a lot of ways. But, I mean, I think you make a great point. If we could just put everything in one bin and there was the facility that could sort through it all, I think that's what you were saying, is how to make the diversion rate higher, is that the facilities would...
Yeah,
have some type of technology.
I think we can find a better balance. I mean, there's very obvious single streams of recycling where it's easy, it makes sense at that point in the project to do that. It's worth making space on the project site to accommodate that, you know, whether it's metal framing material or perhaps drywall or concrete. But then you reach that point in the job where you say there's not the room, there's not the space, let's get back to work and dump it all in one bin. So kind of a middle ground here. I don't think it's an either or.
Yeah, and from my experience, too, I second that not everybody cares about it. In fact, most of the time you're up against great odds to get that done. I mean, people...
Yet you're getting it done. So it's.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with the laborer who's on site, sorting through and kind of managing the subcontractors, teaching the subcontractors. But it's really difficult. Yeah.
Wow, what you kind of a wish list. What, you know, what three things would I as a builder ask for? And I'm usually not as a loss from words, as you could probably tell from my presentation, but I'm at a loss for words right now. That is a great question, and I'd love to get your card, and I'd love to share the answer with Wes and see that it gets posted and shared with everybody, because I appreciate the open invitation. Yeah, I do. I think one thing that probably all builders would agree on would be we would like greater recognition and consideration from our various municipalities for when we do things the right way. Just as these recycling facility representatives that were in here were, you know, biting their tongue in frustration at the folks that go out there and dump it in the fields and claim high recycling rights or diversion rights or whatever rights. You know, same thing with us. We're having to compete against those builders out there as well. So to the extent that there can be a program that builders who use certified facilities get the star on the city website or consideration in bidding, we do a lot of city work, and that doesn't ever seem to be considered. So, but I would love to get your card. Thank you.
I think if you could set up a training, too, for general contractors or subcontractors, you know, step by step, how to recycle as much as you can at a higher rate. However that might be, however you go about achieving that, I think that would be really helpful.
We'll have to leave it there, and that's also a good segue for our next section. Thank you. And Michael, I should say, thank you. Thank you. Don't look too close, because on the other side of that wall in our kitchen, we have a cheat sheet for what goes in which bin. So even we get it wrong sometimes. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So we've got our final panel, which we've got Dennis coming up first. Dennis Corbett's with the City of Pleasanton, and he's going to talk about not just he's the permit sitter manager and the acting building official for the City of Pleasanton. And he's going to talk about Green Halo and what they've done to implement. And this is part of that, we just talked about how can you get the contractor to follow the right steps to do the right thing. And I think you guys have an interesting way to do it.
Good morning. I just want to say I appreciate the previous presentation from Michael and Emily. I was a general contractor for 9 years. The frustrations of that drove me to the other side of the counter 18 years ago. And, you know, I feel as a building department person, you know, we're now all in the same, what used to be called a debris box, now it's a recycling bin, trying to figure out how to do all this and adjust to the new realities of what we have to do. So as I said, I'm with the City of Pleasanton. I've lived there for 24 years. I've worked for the City of Pleasanton for the last 7. And, you know, for anyone who isn't familiar, Pleasanton is a really great city. We scored very high on several national lists and surveys recently in Money Magazine and on 24/7 Wall Street. And this is a snapshot of our city's website, which everyone should go and visit to learn more about the city and come there. I'm very glad as a contractor 24 years ago we were able to scratch and claw and get into the cheapest, smallest house in Pleasanton at the time and raise a family. So Pleasanton has always wanted to stay on the forefront of the green movement. So in 2002, in November, they passed their first green building ordinance. At that time, you know, it was added to the Pleasanton Municipal Code, and it applied to commercial and civic green and civic projects only. Then, 3.5 years later, in March of 2006, they added residential projects. You know, and the projects that it applied to were, you know, anything commercial over 20,000 square feet. Anything residential, pretty much 2,000 square feet or larger, multifamily residential, mixed-use projects, etc., unless it was in the downtown area because they get special rules, or if it was historic. So it didn't apply to too many projects, but it did fall to the building department to try to enforce these regulations. In the early process, as they're going through their planning entitlements, the developers would have to work with the planning department on, at that time, LEED initially, and then when residential came in, the Build a Green checklists. And you know, negotiate exactly how they were going to meet these minimum thresholds with the minimum number of points for each system. So that would happen, and then, you know, it could be quite a bit of time between the time they got their planning entitlement and then eventually their building permits. And as I said, at first it only applied to larger projects, and, you know, it always came down at the end to the building department to try to verify these things were done. And unlike some cities that have deposits for C&D and various things, in Pleasanton it was occupancy that we were going to hold up. And so it created a few problems. We had to try to figure out these things that were new to us. So then in 2010, or at the end of 29, as part of the rest of Alameda County, we adopted our first C&D ordinance. And so in that C&D ordinance, it said that we'll make sure that all projects over $125,000 and or a demolition project over $25,000 would have a waste management plan, and we would verify that they divert 90% of concrete and asphalt, 50% of all other materials from projects that required a permit. And so we said, okay, we came up with this form here, had the contractor fill out the first part, you know, with their estimates of what they were going to generate, and then at the end of the project, then we want to see their receipts and try to verify that they met those minimum requirements. Well, as those projects started coming up, we realized we didn't know how to do that. You know, a contractor gives us their list of various tags for the materials that they've disposed of, and, you know, we didn't know where it came, you know, what the diversion rate was at that facility. You know, it was, we were just totally lost. And so we're trying to call around and see, well, you know, for ceiling tiles, what is the diversion rate on that? We've never done that before. For the drywall, you know, and everything else. So we realized that we were totally inadequate in trying to determine whether someone did this or not. And, you know, what are we doing? We're holding up occupancy. You know, so that obviously did not go over well with a lot of people. And we weren't happy about doing it either. In Pleasanton, we have another wrinkle in that we have an exclusive franchise with Pleasanton Garbage Service. They're the only agency that can drop boxes in the city of Pleasanton. And in our franchise agreement, it says that contractors are authorized to self-haul their own materials to any other facility, but they can't hire someone to haul their materials and their debris out of there. They have to go through PGS. PGS is a relatively small transfer station, so there were projects occasionally where the materials were of a nature or a quantity that they couldn't handle, so then they would give them authorization to take it somewhere else, so we would have them stamp it. And at that time, they were reviewing all those paper plans as we got them. So, you know, as we were struggling with it, Stop Waste here, they started inviting me for some reason to their meetings over here, and started finding out, you know, how we can actually do this process and try to do it right. And they worked with a company called Build It Green, who was building a software to do this for us. And Green Halo. And all I can say is hallelujah for Green Halo, because they have all of that information already programmed into their system. So, you know, through Stop Waste, we were able to start using this on projects in Pleasanton. So, you know, we transitioned away from those paper forms, which, you know, were a little questionable on some of the results on there. And, you know, we had a binder where we put it all in, and when we had to do our annual reporting, it was just a mess. And so now we had a new way of doing it. And, you know, this is the handout that we first came up with, you know, that explained to contractors when they had a project that required a waste management plan, this is how you do it. You can read this, log into Green Halo Systems, create your account, put in your project information, put in your estimates of how much materials you're going to have. Again, it explained to them that this is our franchise agreement, and these are the self-haul guidelines. They have to check that box that they've read that and they understand that, and then it goes forward. So to use Green Hay, and then, you know, not long after that, CalGreen came along. So CalGreen started drawing many, many more projects into the waste management plan requirements. You know, on our ordinance, you know, we had the 125,000, you know, threshold, but a small house, and we do occasionally get houses under 2,000 square feet, was exempt. Well, now all new structures were involved, and now tenant improvements kick in for additional green requirements as well. So we get more and more projects that we have to do this on. And just to give you some numbers for our last fiscal year that ended on June 30th, you know, we issued 3,442 permits in the last year with a valuation of, you know, almost $350 million. 225 of those permits required waste management plans. The staff to handle all this are two permit technicians, two plan checkers, and three building inspectors. So we don't have the time to do all that work that was originally expected of us to do to verify these plans. So again, Green Halo came along, and we also upgraded our permit software to Acela. And so we have our software actually doing, you know, as much work as we can here. And this is just a couple of examples of some scripting, you know, where when it's a building permit and the valuation's $125,000 or more, based on our ordinance, then we check a box saying, yes, there's a waste management plan required. And if it's over $200,000 now, you know, it checks a box that, you know, all of green building applies. So, you know, we take it out of the discretion of our staff so that it does it behind the scenes for them, and it works in a lot of other ways, such as I'll show you here in a second. So this is a picture of what they call application-specific info in our software. And, you know, waste management plan, yes or no. Green building requirements apply, yes or no. Energy, yes or no. And then the waste management plan status, there's four statuses here. If it's not required, if the Green Halo plan wasn't approved because it didn't meet our minimums, if it was accepted, and if it was completed. So scripting, again, holds up inspections on that. So permit gets issued, they got the handout, they need to go set up their plan because they can't schedule any inspections before that. If they try to, with where the status, you know, hasn't been changed, if they haven't gone into Green Halo, you know, if they haven't gotten the plan approved and they try to schedule an inspection, they get this message. Cannot even schedule it until it's been accepted. And we're just looking to make sure it meets our minimum diversion requirements and, you know, some reasonable estimate of the debris that'll get hauled out of there. And, you know, it's just an estimate. We don't hold them to those numbers, but the final results, you know, do matter. So then the second step is, after it's been accepted, they can schedule all the inspections except a final inspection. So then they get this message here, you got to complete your waste management plan in Green Halo, and we can review it before you can even schedule your final inspection. So this has helped us tremendously. To give you an example, this is a Ponderosa project at Cameron Place. They're building 33, I think, homes there. They do it in phases of four, so they put four building permits on the one plan because that's their way of doing it. They estimated they would generate these numbers, and being, you know, an experienced developer, they're actually pretty close. And then this is what they actually ended up with at the end of this phase here. So they met our minimum requirement of 90% for concrete asphalt and 50% for everything else. And, you know, this is more information from Green Halo. It shows you the facilities that they used. In their case, they only went to three different places. A couple of the pictures of the tags that the applicant uploaded into Green Halo, and this is what we look at to make sure that those numbers on here match what they put on their results, and it's been working pretty well for us. Our city manager's office, they can use these numbers to verify what they get from PGS to make sure that they're in the same ballpark for what they're doing for diversions. And it's been very good, and everyone's been very happy with it. We, you know, as I said, Pleasanton tried to stay ahead of the green movement early on, and they still are. Earlier this year, we bumped our minimum diversion rate up to 75%. You know, because we knew the state was going to 65, and so they wanted to maintain a little buffer there. And that does create an interesting challenge, because the mixed C&D rate for Pleasanton garbage service is only 72%. So it is forcing people to do some source separations. And they can do it through PGS, or they can haul it off somewhere else, but they do have to work just a little bit harder at it. You know, as I said, there's lots of reporting, you know, for the state and for the county. So these are our numbers. And see here, our overall diversion rate, you know, is up over 85% now. So we've been pretty good with that. We have just signed a contract with Green Halo. They've changed their business model. So last month we did get the contract finally signed and filled. So we will be utilizing their transition to wastetracker.com. And there'll be a wastetracking.com, and they'll be setting up a new portal inside our city's webpage, and also an API interface with our software system. So those manual steps that we've been changing will be automated. When someone's plan review is approved, they'll start getting an email saying, "Here's a link to your Green Halo plan," so they don't have to go and start their own anymore. And, you know, when that plan is approved, it will automatically update our permitting software. So, yeah, those inspection restrictions are lifted right away. So we're looking forward to those advances. The city of Palo Alto was mentioned. They already have that interface, so we're gonna tag on what they've done and move forward with that. Mary asked to touch on fees. We weren't charging any fees initially for Green Halo. It wasn't in our master fee schedule. Our master fee schedule had not been changed since the late 80s. So needless to say, all our permit revenues were lagging dramatically behind everybody. So we finally got that updated, and we have some new fees. And so those boxes I was talking about for sub-trades and for energy and green building, those are all percentages of fees now, and we have a waste management plan fee of $150, which will cover our contract and cover our staff time, which has been reduced to about an hour total for any project. As I said, at first it took days to try to figure these things out. Now we get an email notification that the plan's been completed in Green Halo, or it's been submitted, and we can go right to it. And you know, just review and spot check unless we're seeing problems. And so it saved us a tremendous amount of time, and we've been very happy we've gone to it. So that's all I got.
Unless people have questions.
Any questions for Dennis?
Patrick. Dennis, on the last line item on the fees, it's $150 for a waste management plan. That covers the project from start to finish, so it also covers staff time to review the closeout report, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and if they do trigger green building requirements, we've included that in the fee here, the 15%, so that's an either or. They're not paying that.
Okay.
And initially, when we started all this, you know, back in 2010, 2011, we thought to cover
Yeah, so by the time the project is over, nobody knows, well,
that email generated automatically once it's been approved, stating that your permit's ready. These are the balance due the fees, and if you have a reason, you can start. But quite often, they are different people, and you still get someone calling up saying, I'm trying to schedule an inspection, and says, I can't. Yeah, told whoever came in. Unfortunately, they didn't give that information to you. But they can have that plan in 10 minutes. It's not hard. If they've done one before, they probably do 5 minutes. And we have computer kiosks that aren't counted. We want to do it right away. But they do it. Yeah, we still get that issue occasionally, but not too much yet. I think everyone's pretty much cut on to that.
Sorry,
you're up.
Any other questions? Great. I just handed out a survey. If you could please, before folks leave, fill those out. And next we're going to have Carrie come up. Thank you, Dennis. That was really good. To talk about the city of Alameda. Thank you.
Okay.
And your experiences with Green Halo. So let me grab the...
Now, I knew that I was going to be the last person speaking today, so I'm going to try to keep this light. I don't have nearly as many numbers about how well we're doing. Well, yes, because Green Halo did save Alameda, and I don't know if you can tell from Dennis's presentation, but it changed things significantly for how we operated things at a really basic level. It does a lot of the work for me. So is this top one, huh? No. Right. Great. So key dates for me, anyway, for Alameda. So mid-2002, our ordinance, our C&D ordinance was ratified, and it said that we would recycle at least 50%. We are there's no specifics about ADC or concrete or things like that, but it does say that we're going to recycle it, and I have to ask that each project owner recycle it. But at that time, it was run by one integrated waste specialist like myself, right? And she ran a bunch of other programs, too, and didn't really have the space or wherewithal to really put together a program of trying to figure out how to track this, right? So while Dennis's city had something put on the books in 2010, we started going with it in about 2011, right? So it doesn't – whenever – we had the ordinance there, but it was so difficult to follow that we – had to just say, well, this is what our requirements are, but we got nothing for you. So in 2007, we had two integrated waste specialists hired, right? And I'm talking really, speaking really to that staff level idea. And one of us was, I was hired at that time, and one of us was hired to specifically look at this, and it wasn't me. In 2010, I saw the presentation for Green Halo for the first time here in this room. And I have kind of a background in software development, meaning I was the business side of software development, and I thought Green Halo was awesome. Like, I'm like, oh, that's it. That's what everybody needs. Why isn't everybody using this? And in fact, so I go back to my city and I say, we need this Green Halo thing, like right now. And the two folks who were kind of overseeing that sort of thing said, yeah, I don't know. It's another piece of software. It's going to cost a lot of money. And it didn't go anywhere. Did nothing. And then there was a layoff. And that one person who was overseeing it, that and a list of other projects, was gone, and it was dropped in my lap. So guess what I thought? Well, and then I had to investigate. Okay, what is it that I'm supposed to be doing here? So I go into our old files, and I'm like, okay, here's what my hauler gives out to all project owners. Okay, if you're going to get a debris box, then you're going to promise to recycle 50% and blah, blah, blah. But that's pretty much all they had. And then, oh, what is this old program? It was an old stop waste program, a rebates program for C&D recycling. Like, you know, okay, here's an incentive. and wait, oh, this is a letter that we say, oh, you're not recycling, and so we need to make sure you're recycling. So make sure you get these permitted haulers and everything, but still, no enforcement, no checking, no records. Oh, and here's an example of you have to keep track of all of these white tags for each project and add them up for the project owner, right? This is not something that was submitted to me. This was something I was supposed to keep track of. What? Like, this is a large project, right? This is Alameda Landing. If you know City of Alameda at all, this is just one little tiny piece of a massive spreadsheet that was monitored by that specialist at that time. And I'm like, this is just an enormous amount of work. Here's an old waste management plan. And I was just like, so this is all they have to give. And I'm supposed to keep track of these paper files, right? Same sort of thing that you're looking at. And I just thought, this is crazy. And all the while, I'm trying to pay attention to the parts of my municipal code that says we must require these project owners. You're going to have to report it, and I have to report it then to Stop Waste once a year, right? And I was getting nothing. I had city projects pretty reliably, and that was about it. And the permitted haulers that were in town, I had numbers from them because they had to give them to me. That's it. Wait, one moment. I got to say one thing about that. So what I found out about permitted haulers, right, if I was going to rely on that for my my overall data, is that I can look in Green Halo. This is just an aside. I can look in Green Halo and see that 59% of projects that are going through the City of Alameda are labeled as self-haul. So I'm getting no data from 59% of the projects if I don't use Green Halo. Okay. So I saw Green Halo. I'm like, okay, we're doing it. And Dean Rados gave me an account. And Mary and Dean came to our building department. I work for Public Works. And Mary and Dean, and we sold it to the building official, right? And to a plan checker and to a permit tech. And we talked about it, and they said, yeah, that looks good and everything. It looks like something Carrie's going to do. And they said, but the building official was earnest and said, okay, Carrie, how do we put this in our plan? And I said, well, I'm not really sure. How do I stop it? And then we thought for a second, my boss at that time said, you know, you are spending so much time on this. Let's start charging money for it. Let's get this integrated into our master fee schedule. So we drilled it down to how many hours I was spending on each part of monitoring this, right? So what we determined with my hourly and overhead, that a paper, waste management and report, would be $322, and significantly cheaper would be an online waste management plan and report. So if you imagine that this was all set up, and it was in our master fee schedule, and the permit department could see that I had fees in there, but as my building department is in a totally different building across town from the Public Works Department, it was very difficult to enforce. And so I'm like, okay, so what kind of sign-ups are you getting? And they're like, well, we've got our Green Halo cards. We give them to everybody. Nothing was happening. So City of Alameda also uses Acela, just like City of Pleasanton. And I was trying to figure out where could we put Green Halo? How do I put the stop on it? How do I make sure that every single project is signing up for this? Because I need it. I can't be chasing after project owners that are not even coming through my office, right? They're coming into an office that is about 3 miles away. So I thought, okay, well, maybe plan review, right? Public Works is somehow involved in that. Maybe the engineers will give their approval on basic building requirements. And that was nixed. Okay, so I said, at permit issuance, while they're right there. And the building official told me, you know what? The municipal code doesn't say they have to report a waste management plan at permit issuance. Like, we're not going to take a waste management plan right there because it doesn't say that in the municipal code. It's required before final inspection. I'm like, okay, that's how far I'm going to get with my building official on that. So I thought, okay, during the work and inspection phase, I could harass each permit owner, right? And try to get this going. Well, you know how that works for most of us who are in here and who are city specialists. It's not that simple. And then at final inspection, could I require it there? Well, most feasibly, yes, right? Because if our municipal code says, well, okay, it's required before final, then okay, I thought, okay, so that's the thing I can use the most. But, so that's there, that's solid. I have to get the building inspectors to agree with it. But that's the easiest thing. So what I found out with the cella is that I can place a condition on each permit, right? I do it slightly differently than you do, I think. I place a condition on each permit that says, and this is specifically for Alameda, all projects that are valued at over $100,000, because this is kind of what it says in our code, that over $100,000 is mandatory and under $100,000 is voluntary. And while we have adopted CalGreen, the building official says, well, we don't have the staff to monitor all the bits of CalGreen. So that's kind of where we sit with it right now. Does that sound familiar? Okay. So I was at first manually placing conditions on all permits valued at over $100,000, and that was in November of last year, right? That was the key. Because then, at final, well, and at that very same moment, when the permit is being issued, they don't have to present a waste management plan, and I know there's a lot of words on this. I brought extra copies in case anyone wants one. But it says that you agree to use the right type of hauler, right? Because I'm trying to get away from the self-haul. We don't know who's hauling it. It's illegal hauling, that sort of thing. And it also says, it details that you have to submit a waste management plan and report. You have to do it before final. That's what's in red. Your project will not pass final inspection if this is not received by me. Signed off and my name and number is at the bottom with an email address, right? So the permits department is putting this in front of each permit holder, which helps. Because they can't say they never received it. And I get it that it's not always the same person, but guess who will tell them? The final inspector. That final inspection. So there is still some... shoot. Okay, so yeah, so you notice that it's still in the front right there, and we've got the permit tech over here handing over my funny little piece of paper that I made on my desktop, right? Final inspection is going to have it. The condition's on there. The inspector is going to hold up the project. And that contractor does call me, right, directly, because they've got my phone number, either from the inspector or from that sheet of paper. And I have had contractors freak out at 8 o'clock in the morning because the inspector's saying they're not eligible for that inspection at the end. However, during the course of that day, they get their waste management plan in, I approve it, they upload their weight tags, and I can approve the final project, and they're out. And that same inspector will go back that next morning probably, and they're good to go. So the supervising building inspector just said to me the other day, because I was asking him, I said, how's it going? Is this a lot more work for you? Is this? He's like, no. I give them your phone number. It's really all on you. And so this, you took a difficult thing, streamlined it, and made it work. I've not alienated my permit techs. I've not alienated my building inspectors, nor the building official. And we are getting some amazing data. I mean, the participation in the program is just shot through the roof. So that, and here's our waste tracking portal, which I'm using and not without an agreement right now. Dean said it was okay. And but we are in process of getting under contract with Green Halo. And so he put this together, and that's the future of Alameda, and Green Halo did save us. Oh my gosh.
Stop wasting the work with Green Halo for quite some time because our goal is for all the cities in Alameda County and beyond to start tracking.
And I just wanted to add that there are implications for this for the processors, for the haulers. I can see that the lion's share of what is coming out of Alameda is going to the Davis Street Transfer Station. I can see, and commercial waste, wherever Josh is. I can't see him right now. And it has implications. I mean, you know, I can place then those names up higher on the city website, right? This informs everything I do in the C&D world, right? This is one of a million programs. And I want it to kind of self-maintain, and Green Halo allows me to do that. So,
excellent. Great. Well, thank you, Carrie. Okay. Great. Well, that concludes the program. We're going to have lunch entering right now. So let's take a quick break, and then lunch is coming. Please fill out your surveys and stick around to hang out over lunch. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Just leave them on your desk or on the table on your way out. Thanks, everyone.